I was raised to believe that the Bible defines good and evil for us within its pages. But when we stop and examine this idea using the Bible, we discover something else. In the Garden of Eden, there were two trees, a tree that would bring life to all who ate of its fruit, and a tree that brought death. And it was the second tree, the tree that resulted in death, that contained the knowledge of good and evil. Have we been deceived by the serpent who is trying to get us to eat of the second tree? Is the Bible really trying to define good and evil for us? Let's take a step back. Let's run an experiment. Instead of seeking to define good and evil, let's instead ask the question of the trees. Let's attempt to define life and death, but to do so, we must first seek it out. So join us as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Hey everybody, welcome to the Derech Chai Experiment, the show where we hang upon every word of scripture in order to get all that we can from the word of God. Well, the book of Judges can be downright fun to read at some times. It tells a lot of stories, and we as humans, we like stories. You see, the human mind attempts to make sense out of data. If we are presented with just a series of numbers or a list of rules or disjointed facts, we will attempt to find the story that connects the data in an understandable way. For example, we are all familiar with crazy laws that are still on the books. In Missouri, it's illegal to drive with an uncaged bear. And in Alabama, it's illegal to wear a fake mustache that causes laughter in a church. We hear these facts and we just really want to know the story behind why these things became laws, because we know that there must be a story. Well, the same happens with the Torah. We read laws and we attempt to create a story for why certain laws are given. For example, many modern Christians will state that the food laws were given for the purpose of keeping Israel separate from the nations around them. This is the story that's been created to excuse the reason for why food is no longer an obedience issue. So now, when Christians are told to go into the world and spread the gospel, we can now eat pork, because that command wasn't for Christians in the first place. And why don't we sacrifice anymore? Well, because the story has been created that the laws of Torah fell into different categories, civil, ceremonial, and moral. And since only the moral laws apply today, that is why we don't sacrifice anymore. Again, a story has been created in an attempt to explain why things are the way that they are. This is just simply human nature. It's part of our psychology to attempt to find a story to explain our circumstances and the data that we take in. Because stories help us to make sense of the world around us. And the simple fact is that lessons can be shared and propagated through stories. A story can be the vehicle for teaching moral principles. This is why the standard introduction on how to craft a sermon says to include an illustration. The pastor is to make their point logically and hermeneutically, and then they're to tell a story that highlights the point that's being made. The story gives the audience the ability to wrap their mind around the proper application of the information. Well, that's what we find happening in the book of Judges. When we first open the Bible, we encounter an entire book of stories of fallible people who God chose to enter into relationship with and make his own. The story of the beginning that helps us to frame everything that comes after. Then comes a book that tells the story of God's power and authority, which culminates in the relationship that's hinted at in the first book being cemented in two sets of instructions, one for how to interact on a personal level, and the other for a tent. The initial story of redemption to help us to then frame our own redemption, and this God who purchased his people out of enslavement. Then come several books that are primary laws of various sorts, with just a few chapters of story mixed in. With the plethora of laws, we are then left to try to make sense of how they can apply to us, and we do that by crafting these stories of how these laws fit together to instruct. Civil, ceremonial, moral? Or is it that they're done away with and we don't have to pay any attention to them? Or is it that they provide foundational ideas and can be extrapolated into most situations? There are any number of ways to craft a framework around how we are to encounter these laws today, but before we can even begin to engage with them, we need a story. Well, after the books of laws and lists is the book of Joshua, a narrative of what the people of Israel did with the instructions that they were given, the faith that they exhibited, and just how far that faith took them when the rubber met the road. And here we are in the book of Judges. In Judges, the stories of the Torah all get rolled into one book. In many ways, Judges is Genesis Part 2. The flawed characters are back, the repeated failures of the people to live up to God's instructions, the world around these people attempting to disrupt and destroy what God has started, and God walking through this all with his people, despite the messes that they make. Just as in Genesis, we find God choosing to work through and with people with obvious flaws. Not the rich and powerful and those who have everything together and are seen as powerful by the world. The weak and outcast of the world. Those who would be unable to accomplish if it weren't for God's power. This is what we find in the majority of the book of Judges. That is, the entirety of the book is made up of these sorts of stories. Except for one place. This chapter. Judges 5 out of the entire book takes a turn from the narrative to the poetic. And so it gets easy when we get here to simply read the words of a song rather than to figure out how that song informs us of the narrative that's going on around and the lesson that it's trying to teach. But what we find instead when we really sit and examine this song is that the people of God are crafting a story that is to be told and to spread throughout the ancient world. We read the narrative of the book that contained what we needed to hear. The song then fills in the gaps and provides the context that serves as a reminder to Israel and a warning to the nations around them. In this song, Israel is framing the narrative that is then to be told to their children, their grandchildren, and the nations around them. So let's read this song, and then let's examine the story that the song tells. Judges chapter 5. And on that day, Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, saying, "For leaders leading in Israel, for the people volunteering, bless Adonai. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I do sing to Adonai. I sing praise to Adonai, God of Israel. Adonai, when you went out from Seir, when you stepped from the field of Edom, the earth shook and the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water. The mountains flowed at the presence of Adonai. This Sinai, at the presence of Adonai, God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar the son of Anat, in the days of Israel the highways were deserted, and the travelers went in crooked ways. Leadership ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, a mother in Israel arose. They chose new gods. Then fighting was in the gates. Neither a shield nor spear was seen among the 40,000 in Israel. My heart is towards the inscribers of Israel, the volunteers among the people. Bless Adonai. You who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets, and you who walk along the way, declare it. By the voice of shouters between the places of drawing water, there they recount the righteous acts of Adonai, the righteous acts of his leadership in Israel. Then the people of Adonai shall go down to the gates. Wake up, Deborah. Wake up, sing a song. Arise, Barak, to lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. Then he sent the remnant to rule the nobles. Adonai came down from me against the gods. Out of Ephraim their root is against Amalek. After you, Benjamin, with your peoples out of Machir, inscribers came down, and out of Zebulun those who handle the scribes read. And the heads of Issachar were with Deborah, and as Issachar, so was Barak sent into the valley under his command. Among the divisions of Reuben there were great searchings of heart. Why did you remain among the sheepfolds to hear the bleatings of the flocks? The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. Gilead, remain beyond the Jordan. And why did Dan remain on ships? Asher continued at the seashore and remained by its landing places. Zebulun is a people who risked their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also on the heights of the field. Kings came, they fought. Then the king of Canaan fought in Taanach. By the waters of Megiddo, they took no spoils of silver. From the heavens they fought, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. The wadi of Kishon swept them away, that age-old wadi. The wadi of Kishon, O my soul, you have trampled in strength. Then stamped hoofs of horses with the galloping of the steeds. Curse Maroz, said an angel of Adonai. Curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of Adonai, among the mighty. Blessed among women is Jael, the wife of Heber, the Canaanite. Above women in tents she is blessed. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, and her right hand to the workman's hammer. Then she pounded Sisera. She smashed his head. She pierced and struck through the side of his head. Between her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay still. Between her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell, destroyed. Through the window the mother of Sisera looked and cried out through the lattice, "Why does his chariot delay to come? Why have the steps of his chariots tarried?" The wise ones of her princesses answer her. Indeed, she answers herself. Do they not find and divide the spoil? A girl or two for each man, a spoil of dyed work for Sisera, a spoil of dyed work richly embroidered for the necks of the looter. So do all your enemies perish, O Adonai, but let those who love him be like the sun, rising in its might. And the land had rest for 40 years. Chapters such as this are a bit difficult to teach on. The nature of this chapter being song that retells the story of the previous chapter means that a lot of what this song relates intellectually we already covered last week. In fact, last week we turned to this chapter in order to answer the question of why Sisera would leave his iron chariot in order to escape on foot from a poorly armed Israelite army. This sounds like abandoning a tank because someone with a pistol has decided to attack you. Why would you ever do such a thing? And the answer is found here. Verse 4. The clouds dropped water. Verse 21, the torrent Kishon swept them away. The flat valley, which was an integral part of the technological dominance of the iron chariots of Sisera, turned into a wet and muddy mess, and the asset of iron chariot became a liability. But there's more to the story of the battle with Sisera than just this. At least, there's more that Deborah and Barak wished for the world to know. The song presents some of the conditions in Israel prior to the raising of the army. It tells of the tribes that answered the call and some that did not. It also speaks clearly of God's involvement in the battle and the scope of the battle. And it finishes by imagining what Sisera's mother might be thinking as she waits for her son to return victorious from the battle. So let's examine each of these elements and see how they help us to better understand the narrative of the previous chapter. In the opening, the song begins in the same way as the Song of Moses. It addresses a potential audience that the song is addressed to. Compare Deuteronomy 32:1 and Judges 5:3. Deuteronomy 32:1. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Judges 5:3 says, Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes, to the Lord I will sing. I will make the melody to the Lord, the God of Israel. In Deuteronomy 32, it was the heavens and the earth that were to act as witnesses to the words of the song of that chapter. Here in Judges chapter 5, it is the kings and princes of the earth, the leaders of the surrounding nations, that this song is addressed to. And how do I know that this is addressed to the nations? Because Israel had no king in those days. This song was meant to be a testimony that was to be spread and sung as a warning to any other nation that would dare to raise its arms against Israel. Our God fights for us. Our tribes fight together. And though we might look weak, we will have victory because of the power of our God. Verses 4 through 5 speak of Adonai coming from Mount Sinai by way of Seir to bring victory in this fight. Remember that in the ancient worlds, gods were territorial, so this matter of recounting God's approach from the mountain that was far away and passing through a land that was not Canaan is a reminder to these nations that Adonai is not bound by space as their gods were. He is greater. He hears and acts, even though his mountain is so far away. Verses 6 through 9 then set up the state of Israel before Deborah and Barak were chosen. Highways were abandoned, villages were no more because of oppression, everyone had to live in walled cities or die. Shield and spear were not to be found due to the oppression of the enemy. It was not uncommon in the ancient Near East when a foreign nation would occupy the land of an enemy for the oppressor to forbid weapons in the land that they had taken over. Israel did not have weapons with which to fight this war. In verse 9, the song recognizes those men who would step up as commanders to lead this weaponless army out to fight against a superior enemy. Honor is given to the men who had the courage to take on these iron chariots despite their chances of being completely destroyed in battle. Verses 10 through 11, the song then turns to a bit of encouragement for those who were to spread this song. Those who travel and are rich riding donkeys, and those who travel while walking, and the minstrel who sings at the places where people gather. Sing this song and tell of this victory. But this song is not a song of victory of a mighty people over their enemies. The song is a song of victory for the God of Israel. He alone won this fight because Israel was in such a weak place they had no strength of arms or numbers. Verses 12 through 18 then tells of the tribes of Israel and their places in the fight. Now, not every tribe in Israel is listed here, only the tribes that were under the power of Jabin in some way. This would be tribes that held land that contained or was bordered by the area that Jabin controlled. Of these tribes, only Ephraim, Benjamin, Zebulun, Issachar, and at the end of this section, Naphtali, is recounted as answering the call of Deborah and Barak to fight. Reuben, Dan, and the tribes on the other side of the Jordan and Gilead, which included Reuben and Manasseh. Now, Manasseh is not explicitly named here in these verses, but the territory of West Manasseh would have been in the area controlled by Jabin, and yet they are not named here. Did they join the fight or not? Unfortunately, we can't know. What we do know is that the tribes in the Gilead area on the other side of the Jordan did not. Not only was Israel weak in weapons, they were weak in numbers. They weren't even able to unify all of their kinsmen who were also being oppressed. There were those who saw too much risk, those who had too much to lose, those who didn't think Israel could possibly win, and so they did not answer the summons to battle to their shame. Because in victory, the victors get to tell the story, and in their story, they tell of the failure of others to answer the summons to war. Verse 19 through 22 then tells the real story. It didn't matter if Israel was unified. It didn't matter if they didn't have the weapons. It didn't matter if they didn't have the strategy or the numbers. The battle was not won on the ground by the soldiers. The battle was fought and won in the heavens. The victory did not come through strength of arms or technology. The victory came through the torrent that God brought to wash away the enemy, and it was God's cavalry that routed the enemy soldiers. Verse 23 then speaks of a place that is never mentioned before or again, Maroz. No one knows where Maroz is or what role it played in the battle, other than that this place did not support Israel in their fight. It's been postulated that this was perhaps a town that was washed away in the flood that routed Sisera's troops, but that's just speculation. Was this place and its inhabitants already cursed, and the song is attributing this curse to the angel of the Lord? Or is this a curse that's being leveled against this place with hopes that it would be fulfilled in the future? I tend towards the first option, that this place was destroyed, and a curse from the angel of the Lord is the given reason for its destruction, because of their failure to assist Israel when the battle came. Verse 24 through 27 then shames Sisera for all the world to hear. In the ancient Near East, it was shameful for a man, especially a warrior, to be killed by a woman. We'll see this later in Judges 9, 52 through 54, when Abimelech has a millstone crush his head while besieging a city. When this occurs, he has enough wherewithal to ask one of his soldiers to kill him so that it will not be said that he was killed by a woman. This song that was to be spread far and wide relates the means of victory when a woman defeated the great commander. Not only is Sisera being shamed, the absurdity of the victory is being pressed even harder. It wasn't even a soldier that won the fight for us. Our fighting men could have stood back, and we still would have won. The victory belonged to a river and a woman. Israel is taking no glory for this victory in this song. The sheer volume of the odds stacked against them and the absurdity of their actual victory can only be attributed to one source. The victory truly belonged to Adonai. And what a victory it was. This victory was so complete that in verses 28 through 30, there was no one left to deliver the news of defeat to Sisera's poor mother. She was left sitting in her chamber, imagining that his return was delayed because Sisera was so preoccupied with pillaging and raping his way through Israel as he gathered the spoils of war. In fact, the song paints the picture of Sisera's mother imagining the victory to be so complete that the reason that no messenger was available to bring the news was because of the sheer amount of plunder that was to be had. And the contrast is that the victory was so complete in the other direction that there was no person left in the armies of Sisera to do such a simple task as relate the defeat back to the people. Not a single person escaped from this battle to run home and deliver the news. Now, is this true? Well, in the minds of Barak and Deborah and everyone who heard this song from then on, it was most certainly true. Now, this song is incredible for what it is. It's a song of praise, but it's not primarily a song of praise. It's a song of war, but it's not primarily a song of war. It's a song of history, but it's not primarily a song of history. This song is a piece of ancient propaganda. It's an example of Israel taking control of the narrative and determining what everyone else talks about as they discuss the war. It is Israel crafting the story surrounding their victory, and in doing so, they make one thing clear. It was not by strength of arms that we won. It was not by overwhelming numbers that we won. It was not because of great tactics that we won. It is not because of our great leaders or generals that we won. There is nothing in us or our people that caused us to gain the victory. We won simply and solely because our God fought for us and gave us the victory. Once again, this is something that we will see called out specifically in the upcoming story of Gideon. This later generation, if they had enough soldiers when they fought the Midianites, they would claim the victory for themselves and attribute their success to their own fight. We'll see this later again in the story of Hezekiah that's told in three different books of the Tanakh. When Hezekiah recovered from his deathbed, he was given a sign. The shadow on the sundial moved back 10 steps. This means that the sun moved backward in the sky a significant distance, and the world obviously observed it. And when Babylon sent envoys to question about Hezekiah's recovery, instead of pointing to God, he took them and showed them his wealth and his military power. And this too is human nature. It is part of our tendency to craft stories to make sense of the world. When things don't make sense, we point to things that do make sense. When God heals a disease, people point to the placebo effect or some treatment as the answer. When underdogs win the fight, well, the other team did not show up, or they underestimated the victors. When an army wins a battle against overwhelming arms, it's better tactics, better strategy, and bravery that are attributed for the win. But each of these things is situational. Placebo effect only works sometimes. Underestimating your opponent is a short-term mistake. Good tactics can be overcome by better tactics. If Israel had focused on strength of arms or tactical advantage, then those looking in from the outside would only see something to be taken. Another enemy would rise to test this mettle against this upstart nation who wins wars with farming tools. Every man is beatable, after all. But when a nation's God fights for them to the point where they are able to bring everyone who is against them into complete ruin, ruin to the point that no one remained to return news of the defeat, ruin to the point that those who did not support Israel were wiped out, ruin to the point where women in tents and rainstorms become your downfall in battle. Israel's God fights for them, is the message of this song. Go and spread the word far and wide. Do not mess with Israel, and do not mess with her people. You will not win. You cannot win. Their God fights for them. And this is the point of this chapter. Our victories in life are not our own. Our victories belong to God. He is the one who creates a way when there is no other way. We should not be searching for ways to attribute his actions on our behalf to other sources. But that takes God off the pedestal and puts nature, or wealth, or intelligence, or power on the pedestal. Modern people looking in on this victory could easily point to Sisera's overconfidence and a rainstorm as the reason that Israel won. There's no need to ascribe divine intervention in this. But the rains are in the hands of God. He brings the rain both in and out of season. And it's our responsibility, even our duty, to give God the glory for all good things that come into our lives. We are to bear the testimony of our God. We are to tell of the wonderful things that he has done. We are to credit him for every good thing in our lives, for he is the source of it all, and he deserves all of the glory. In humbling ourselves this way, in order to give God the glory for the things that he has done through us, we will find life. So Derech Chai, seek life in all that you do. Shalom.
Thank you for tuning in to Derech Chai. If this content has blessed you and you would like more, please consider subscribing, liking, commenting, and sharing with others. To find out more about what we do and to support this ministry, head over to seeklifesc.com. That's seeklifesc.com. We'll see you again next time as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Shalom.